Blog Talk Radio.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. A soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way, and he's fighting for democracy, or fighting for the red, he says it's for the peace of all. Die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon in a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. This is not the way we put an end to war.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. I saw a headline today. I misread it, actually. I thought it said, FBI agent who outed Petraeus OD'd. I looked again. I realized it was ID, not OD. Kind of makes you wonder, though. Maybe it was a premonition. After all, it's usually not too healthy to get on the wrong side of the CIA. Just like it's not healthy to get on the wrong side of the British royal family. A certain princess discovered that a few years back, or rather failed to realize it soon enough. Before her untimely end, when her chauffeur got his brain scrambled, drink spiked, whatever it was that happened. Convenient accident? I doubt it. I think it was just a little mind game. Get the guy high, get him scared, get some folks to give chase, and boom. I could be wrong, of course. It's happened before. It'll happen again. Who knows? Not I, that's for sure. But I wonder. We talk a lot on this show about the flaws in the old version of the American dream and the sorts of things we dream of. What defines our new American dream? I came across a passage written about 50 years ago by one of my favorite novelists. It's pretty strange that this came from what we think of as a thriller, because there's a deep insight into the misconceptions of society. I'm going to read it. Santa Rosita was a stunted version of the Santa Barbara code of existence. Three industries, electronics, plastics, and tourists, and squeezed the bejesus out of all three. It was sharing the big boom boom, the incomparably dull tract houses glitteringly new were marching out across the hills, cluttered with identical station wagons, identical children, identical barbecues, identical tastes in flowers and television. You see, Virginia, there really is a Santa Rosita full of plastic people in plastic houses, and areas nudged by the vast basketry of their shopping centers, but did not blame them for being so tiresome and so utterly satisfied with themselves. Because, you see, there's no one left to tell them what they are, what they really should be doing. The dullest wire services the world has ever seen fill their little monopoly newspapers with self-congratulatory pap. Their radio is unspeakable. Their television is geared to a minimal approval by 30 million of them. And anything 30 million people like, aside from their more private functions, is bound to be bad. Their schools are group adjustment centers fashioned to shame the rebellious. Their churches are weekly votes of confidence in God. Their politicians are enormously likable, never saying a cross word. The goods they buy grow increasingly more shoddy each year, though brighter in color. For those who still read, they make do for the most part with the portentous gruntings of Urish, Walk, Rand, and others of that same witless ilk. Their magazine fair is fashioned by nervous committees. You see, dear, there's no one left to ask them a single troublesome question, such as, where have you been, and where are you going, and is it worth it? They're the undisturbed, the sleep lovers. And they fill out an enormous number of forms every year, humbly and sincerely. Each one is given a number to use all his life. Are they going to be awakened with a kiss? They feel vaguely uneasy about their young. My God, why can't these kids appreciate this best of all possible worlds? What's wrong with these restless punks, these goddamn dropouts? Virginia, dear, through the strange alchemy of the gods, there are a disproportionate number of kids coming along these days with IQs that are soaring toward a level too high to measure. These kids have very cold eyes. They're the ones who one day will stop playing with transistors, diodes, microcircuitry, and look at Barrentown and start asking the rude questions or build a machine that will ask. In the meanwhile, Virginia, Santa Rosita still exists, and it is as if some cynical genius had designed a huge complex penal colony in the sunshine, eliminating the need for guard towers and barbed wire by merely beaming a gigantic electronic message at the inmates day and night, saying, "You are in heaven! Be happy! If you can't be happy there, you can't be happy anywhere! Vote, consume, donate, and don't forget to use your number." These were the thoughts of a beach bum who works only when he has to, who lives on a big houseboat right here in Fort Lauderdale, a modern Robin Hood who steals things back from people who've taken them away from good or reasonably good people. Crab doesn't work cheap. If he gets your stuff back for you, he gets to keep half, plus expenses. There are likely to be some casualties along the way. But somehow, the morality of John D. McDonald's Travis McGee makes a great deal of sense to me. I'm not the big type, nor am I capable of the violence he uses to stay alive. But I admire him. Yeah, I admire him. Tonight's writer, J. Carlos Perez, has written an entirely different sort of book. Relius, the protagonist, is not trying to get anything back for anyone. He doesn't want to take things for himself. Instead, he's wrestling with guilt that stemmed from and is magnified by his South American Hispanic heritage and the attitudes and actions of those around him. He meets fascinating and wonderful people and perhaps falls in love just a little bit, although he doesn't value himself highly enough to feel he should be allowed to fall in love. Little people, or rather people with little minds, beat the heck out of his girl just because she's with him. The novel is about displacement, a hero, flawed and introspective, who still draws you into his world. Maybe it's not that different from John D. McDonald's work after all. You know, so many people really do see what's going on in America, what's going wrong. A lot of them see ways to fix little things, but despair at making any real change. Perhaps you are one of these people. I want to remind you that every little change makes a difference, and that every big change is made up of a plethora of little changes. Don't give up. To paraphrase the famous prayer, keep changing the things you can. Don't get bogged down with the things you can't change and have the wisdom to know the difference. Here's a little thought from a dear departed friend, Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show. I welcome you, and now I'm going to turn the show over to Mike Pelichek, my friend, an American writer.
Hey, Chuck. As you mentioned, tonight our special guests are J. Carlos Perez and also Michael Skinner. Carlos will be speaking to us, I believe, from California, perhaps the greater Los Angeles area, and Michael Skinner will be speaking, I believe, from New Hampshire. So tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Goffstown, New Hampshire, and perhaps the greater Los Angeles area and wherever you are. Okay, I want to talk about Bobo Fay, B-O-B-O-F-A-Y, on the Conan O'Brien show last night, or maybe it was two nights ago. Bobo is on the cast of the Finding Bigfoot show on Animal Planet, which opened its third season this past Sunday. At first, I thought it was nothing when I was skimming channels, but now I think it is something. Talking about Bigfoot on big-time, late-night American mainstream television, it's a breakthrough. It actually is. I'm going to be optimistic, and maybe that's not such a stretch. Talking about Bigfoot on mainstream TV, and how much longer until we see Richard Dolan talking about UFOs on mainstream TV, or Jim Fetzer talking about the Paul Wellstone assassination, or the JFK assassination, or until we see Kevin Barrett talking about 9/11. Or William Pepper talking about the Martin Luther King assassination or the Robert F. Kennedy assassinations. Because Dolan, Fetzer, Barrett, and Pepper are experts at this, and it would be a world-changing event if any or all of them could be on so that people could actually see them, such as on late-night mainstream TV. Maybe we'll start talking to each other, this American nation, because there's a lot we need to talk about. We are like an extremely dysfunctional family that hasn't talked about things for a very, very long time. And that family actually plans to never talk about certain things. That's how it plans to function from now until forever. Some things we just never talk about. We laugh, go to work, talk together sometimes. We attend funerals and weddings, get through it all somehow by means of cigarettes and beer. And on Thanksgiving, we watch football in silence until we can escape to our own caves and dens. But then one year, when nobody expects it, during Thanksgiving dinner, Uncle Frank, who nobody really knows that much about except your dad, he's not talking. Well, Uncle Frank makes a joke about something, and everybody shouts, "No shit," with their open mouths and wide eyes. And everyone runs out into the backyard with spades and begins to dig, and by God, that is where the bodies are buried. And everyone starts talking about everything in family history and genealogy, and they pull out the cards and the board games. And nobody goes home all night just talking and drinking coffee, and the next morning, well, it's like a whole new world. The whole world is new, and not because somebody brought a gun or a knife to Thanksgiving dinner because they had about had it, but by some fluke, something not really planned, except maybe by courageous old weird Uncle Frank, everybody started talking. So Bobo talking about Bigfoot on big time TV. Well, that might be what the revolution looks like. We always wondered, is this the revolution? Is that the revolution? Well, maybe the revolution is a big dude with a California accent in a flannel shirt and jeans wearing a keep on squatching cap. Far out. Okay, then, back to you, Chuck.
The Adventures of Fighting Father Jack Duffy, War Priest of West Omaha. He got his name from having told the guys in seminary up in St. Paul. He used to box in South O, so he'd be known as a regular guy. Then when he got ordained, the bishop even said, fighting Father Jack Duffy when he put the holy oils on his head. Well, a few years later, the Air Force asked him to come out to Offutt and blessed the new chapel with a stained glass window depicting the airman running for his bomber with the mushroom cloud in the background with the words, "Send me, Lord!" Made him an honorary airman, gave him a bumper sticker and a sticker for his gold chalice. Father Jack's now the senior priest, the pastor at St. Ronnie since Bill Kropp retired. Last Sunday was Veterans Day. Fighting Father Jack Duffy, War Priest of West Omaha, put on his camo robes with his Air Force ball cap. He was hurrying all around trying to get ready and in the sacristy, helping the altar boys get their camo surplices over their head. Then he had to dash out into the church to make sure the choir wore camo, and the ushers had the Air Force, Marines, Navy, and Army ball caps to pass out to everybody at the door. The big Joseph and Mary statues on both sides of the altar wore banners across their chest like beauty pageant contestants that freedom isn't free. The regular United States flag on the altar had been supersized and now it was stretched across the whole back wall. Soldiers recently returned from Afghanistan would do the readings. As an ordained minister of the gospel, Father Jack has taken the liberty of asking a returning soldier, who's also a Eucharistic minister who takes communion to people in the nursing homes, he asked him to rewrite the gospel of Luke to fit Veterans Day and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A returning soldier, the Eucharistic minister, Bob. Bob was in Fallujah back in the very early days of the war. He took on Father Duffy's request to rewrite the Gospel of Luke. He called it the Gospel according to Fallujah. When it came time for the Gospel, Bob stood when Father Jack Duffy nodded. He walked up to the podium. From his back pocket, Bob drew out the paper, spread it on the lectern, and began to read. It was a hotbed of insurgency. It was Operation Phantom Fury. It was the smell that first hit me, a smell that's difficult to describe, one that will never leave me. It was the smell of death. Hundreds of corpses were decomposing in the houses, gardens, and streets of Fallujah. Bodies were rotting where they'd fallen. Bodies of men, women, children, many half-eaten by wild dogs. wave of hate had wiped out two-thirds of the town, destroying houses and mosques, schools and clinics. This was the terrible and frightening power of the U.S. military assault. The accounts I heard over the next few days will live with me forever. You may think you know what happened at Fallujah, but the truth is worse than you could possibly have imagined. In one of the makeshift refugee camps that surround Fallujah, we found a 17-year-old woman. "I'm from the Jolan district," she told me. Five of us, including a 55-year-old neighbor, were trapped together in our house when the siege began. American Marines came to our house. My father and the neighbor went to the door to meet them. We were not fighters. We thought we had nothing to fear. I ran into the kitchen to put on my veil, since men were going to enter our house and it would be wrong for them to see me with my hair uncovered. This saved my life. As my father and neighbor approached the door, the Americans opened fire on them. They died instantly. Me and my 13-year-old brother hid in the kitchen behind the fridge. The soldiers came into the house and caught my older sister. They beat her. Then they shot her. But they did not see me. Soon they left, but not before they destroyed our furniture and stole the money from my father's pocket. Hada told me how she comforted her dying sister by reading verses from the Quran. After 4 hours, her sister died. For 3 days, Hada and her brother stayed with their murdered relatives, but they were thirsty. They had only a few dates to eat. They feared the troops would return and decided to try to flee the city, but they were spotted by a U.S. sniper. Hada was shot in the leg. Her brother ran but was shot in the back and died instantly. Someone named Ayad told me that the survivors of another family from the Jolan district, they said at the end of the second week of the siege, the U.S. troops swept through the Jolan. The Iraqi National Guard used loudspeakers to call on people to get out of the houses carrying white flags, bringing all their belongings with them. They were ordered to gather outside near the mosque in the center of town. 8 members of one family, one of them a 6-month-old child, gathered their belongings and walked in single file as instructed to the mosque. When they reached the main road outside the mosque, they heard a shout, but they could not understand what was being shouted. Ayad told me it could have been "now" in English. Then the firing began. U.S. soldiers appeared on the roofs of surrounding houses, opened fire. Ayad's father was shot in the heart, his mother in the chest. They died instantly. 2 of Ayad's brothers were also hit, one in the chest and one in the neck. 2 of the women were hit, one in the hand and one in the leg. Then the snipers killed the wife of one of Ayad's brothers. When she fell, her 5-year-old son ran over to her and stood over her body, so they shot him dead too. Survivors made desperate appeals to the troops to stop firing. But Ayad told me that whenever one of them tried to raise a white flag, they were shot. After several hours, he tried to raise his arm with the flag, but they shot him in the arm. Finally, he tried to raise his hand, so they shot him in the hand. The 5 survivors, including the 6-month-old child, lay in the street for 7 hours. Then 4 of them crawled to the nearest home to find shelter. The next morning, the brother who was shot in the neck also managed to crawl to safety. They all stayed in the house for 8 days, surviving on roots and 1 cup of water, which they saved for the baby. On the 8th day, they were discovered by some members of the Iraqi National Guard and taken to the hospital in Fallujah. They heard the Americans were arresting any young men, so the family fled the hospital and finally obtained treatment in a nearby town. They did not know in detail what happened to the other families who'd gone to the mosque as instructed, but they they told me the street was awash with blood. We heard the accounts of families killed in their houses, wounded people dragged into the streets and run over by tanks. A container with the bodies of 481 civilians inside, of premeditated murder, looting, and acts of savagery and cruelty that beggar belief. I remember being approached by an elderly woman, her eyes raw with tears. She grabbed my arm, told me how her house had been hit by a U.S. bomb during an air raid. The ceiling collapsed on her 19-year-old son, cutting off both his legs. She could not get help. She could not go into the streets because the Americans had posted snipers on the roofs for killing anyone who ventured out, even at night. She tried her best to stop the bleeding, but it was to no avail. She stayed with him, her only son, until he died. He took 4 hours to die. Fallujah's main hospital was seized by the U.S. troops in the first days of the siege. The only other clinic was hit twice by U.S. missiles. Its medicines and medical equipment were all destroyed. There were no ambulances. The two ambulances that came to help the wounded were shot up and destroyed by U.S. troops. We visited houses in the Jolan district, a poor working-class area in the northwestern part of the city that had been the center of resistance during the April siege. This quarter seemed to have been singled out for punishment during the second siege. We moved from house to house, discovering families dead in their beds or cut down in living rooms or in the kitchen. House after house had furniture smashed, possessions scattered. In some places, we found bodies of fighters dressed in black with ammo belts. But in most of the houses, the bodies were civilians. Many were dressed in house coats. Many of the women were not veiled, meaning there were no men other than family members in the house. There were no weapons, no spent cartridges. It became clear to us we were witnessing the aftermath of a massacre, the cold-blooded butchery of helpless and defenseless civilians. Nobody knows how many died. The occupation forces are now bulldozing the neighborhoods to cover up their crime. What happened in Fallujah was an act of barbarity. The whole world must be told the truth. This is the gospel of the Lord, Bob said. Thanks be to God, repeated the congregation. Bob lowered his head and stumbled to his seat and began to sob. Fighting Father Jack Duffy, war priest of West Omaha, bounded down from his padded chair up on the altar, stood in front of the congregation, raised his hands, smiled, and said, "Freedom isn't free! Please turn your hymn books to the Star Spangled Banner and stand with me as we honor America." And I ask the ushers now begin to take up the collection.
The mind of an American rules the world. The President, Warren Buffett, Tiger Woods, Katie Couric, John Stewart, the Michelin Man? No, stupid, it's you. You are king of the world, God, Superman, King Midas, all that. It's you. You are more than just a legend in your own mind. You are the man. And when the CIA, through the CIA propaganda machine called Radio Free Europe or the American Free Press, tells you the Russians are coming, or the criminals are coming, or terrorists, or the Iranians or Iraqis on Afghans, or Afghans on nuclear-powered blue donkeys or big bees are coming, and you believe it, well then, Zeke, that's how the world will go. You are powerful, the most powerful Yahoo who has ever lived in the history of living. And you are an idiot. And the world is going to burn. You're not an idiot on purpose, but an idiot nonetheless. The CIA, the persons in the CIA are smart, but they are evil. The actual evil empire, and they control you, the most powerful person in the world. If you were not an idiot, they could not do that, but you are an idiot. And that's a bummer, man.
Our first guest tonight is J. Carlos Perez, a freelance writer who's written a wonderful novel, Sights and Memories and Closing Eyes. We'll discuss its autobiographical basis, as well as the issues he's observed for Hispanic immigrants. His protagonist encounters discrimination, wrestles with such issues as faith, and even murder. Carlos, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Thank you, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I told the people a little bit about the book. Can you tell us a little more, especially focusing on, why you wrote it and, maybe where it came from and where you came from?
Sure. Well, I was born in Peru, but I was raised in Ohio. And when I was growing up in Ohio, particularly in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a story that came out of Pennsylvania about a young man that had been traveling through Pennsylvania from New York, and his car broke down, and he ended up in a small rural town in Pennsylvania and was actually beaten. And what struck me about the story was that the man who was beaten had lived a fairly comfortable kind of assimilated life in New York. He'd never really experienced that type of racism before. And it just stayed on my mind throughout the years. And as I got older and I experienced my own different variations of assimilation or discrimination and questions of identity and identity politics, the story just kind of came together. And finally, I just wanted to write it down. And so I did. As a fiction. This is a story of fiction.
How long, over what period of time did you write it? I mean, once you got to it, did it just pour out, or did it take years and years? What was your writing process?
It took years. I initially, when I started writing it, and one of the reasons the name of the character is Relius is because I initially started to write something a little bit different, and it kind of morphed into what it is. What I started writing was more or less a modern take on St. Augustine. And I wanted to examine the frailty of a human being who wants to do something better. And as I was writing it, I realized for my own sense of authenticity that I actually had to situate it more into something that I was very kind of immediately familiar with. And I started writing it while I was in graduate school. And so that was quite a while ago in the the late 1990s. Well, I was a grad student at Berkeley, and I finished it shortly after I was advanced to candidacy. So it took me about 2 years, and then I just revised it. I've been revising it and kind of revisiting it over the years until I finally felt like I had enough perspective and distance from it to put it out there and invite people to read it, and that's what I've just done recently.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you finally chose to publish it or have it published or whatever, and I enjoyed it very much. You mentioned the themes of man trying to do better for his fellow man and so forth, and so that's something we talk about a lot on this show. Sometimes we talk about issues of faith, and Relius is wrestling with or wrestling against the faith that he grew up with. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, a lot of what he struggles with is something kind of similar to what I experienced growing up in the United States, having been born in Peru. And I was raised in a very religious household in the U.S., but the traditions that we had in our home were the ones that came with us from Peru, and so they were fairly isolating in a way, particularly because I grew up in the suburbs of Ohio, in northern Ohio, in the suburbs of Cleveland. And so what I wanted to do, or what I found myself doing with Relius, was discovering a character that had to struggle with his own sense of faith, because even though he didn't believe in what he was raised to believe in, he still at times felt trapped by the traditions, or even conflicted by the traditions that were still alive in him, even if the faith was not.
Relius meets a lot of interesting people, especially in the small town where he kind of ended up for a while. I felt for that part of the book, it was like an affirmation of the really good things of humanity. But then all of a sudden things kind of got dark when the beating up of the girlfriend really was where things turned, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that's so fascinating about even small towns in America and small towns in Peru. Actually, the town in the novel is kind of a made-up place. It's supposed to be Midwestern, but in order to create it, I borrowed from experiences that I had from the small village I was from in Peru called Chachapoyas, and also from the towns that I'd visited just throughout my life growing up in the Midwest, and from some time that I spent working on a farm in Germany. So I combined all of those in order to create this place that has the elements of a really good, nurturing environment, but also has that sort of dark side to it that can emerge on its own just from the possibility of three young men finding themselves bored and out of control and maybe misguided, and, well, especially in their leader, I guess, the character of Luke, who seems like he's the one who really takes charge of the other two boys who eventually attack Rebecca.
How do you feel that, is this a parable for America in a way?
In a way, yeah, actually, because I think one of the things that strikes me about America is, particularly when talking about Hispanics or Latinos, is that the usual assumption is that the Latino who experiences racism is the type that's typically depicted on television. And I live in California now, and out here there's always the running joke of having an Hispanic landscaper. And the assumption often seems to be that the Latino is an uneducated or suffering individual in order to experience the type of racism that can visit them in this country or anywhere. And what I found is actually a little bit different from that, in that that type of racism that can be experienced by the Latino happens at any level. It's not just a socioeconomic thing. It sometimes and often happens even after you feel like you've become sort of the ideal of a lot of immigrants, and that is an assimilated American. You're still often judged, first and foremost, not by what you've accomplished, but by your appearance. And this is anecdotal, but I recall when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, I had a professor in one of my seminars interrupt me while I was speaking, making a comment about something or another, and just said that my English was very good, which I thought was surprising, given that I'd grown up in the United States, even though I was born in Peru, and I was certain that nobody else in the class would have had that said to me.
With faint praise or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how people can be so insulting without even realizing it, and probably without intending it.
Yeah, very much so. It reminds me of other things, like in some social settings, I've had people, friends, tell me that they don't think of me as a minority because of my educational background. And I just think, well, okay, that's not quite accurate. You know, you can't really get away with doing that. Just because I've been fortunate doesn't displace me from my past or from my culture or from the prejudices that people like me who haven't been as fortunate have to endure, I think, to a much harsher degree.
Carlos, we're running a little late tonight, and I'm going to have to cut this short at this point, but it's been fascinating talking with you, and I highly recommend to our listeners, Sights and Memories and Closing Eyes. And why don't you tell them where they can find it?
They can actually find it at Amazon. It's available for your Kindle. So go to search on the Amazon.com for Sights and Memories and Closing Eyes. It's the book there by J. Carlos Perez, the letter J.
All right. Is there, do you do any, appearances or anything? Do you want to tell people to find you somewhere or?
The easiest way to reach me is actually through my website, which is my copywriting website, and that is Scrivenry, Scrivenry.com. And all my contact information is there, as well as the other type of writing I do, which is more commercial.
Okay. Well, commercial writing is okay. We've all got to pay the bills,
yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Definitely.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show, and have a good night.
Thank you, Chuck. You too.
This portion of our program is being provided to you by the good folks at The Next Big Thing. New apps for your phone, more stuff for you to do while you're doing that boring driving thing. Well, folks, hold on to your hats because this new app is going to rock your world. It's the application that allows you to deal with the fact that some things you think are laughable now are real. Download it today. Well, maybe tomorrow. We're working on it. We're getting dangerously close to the time when everyone will know that 9/11 was done by the U.S. government and the Israeli Mossad. We're not sure if you're ready for that, and that's why we're working overtime on new apps for you. The folks at The Next Big Thing ask you to be careful what you hope for, huh? What happens the day Barack Obama and George W. Bush and his father are walked out of the golf course in handcuffs, charged with prior knowledge and hiding information about a felony, the attacks of 9/11? And a thoughtful U.S. Marshal puts his hand on George Sr.'s head so he does not bump it on the door of the squad car, and we get the final public sneer of that career criminal. And it appears on the front page of the New York Post and Time Magazine and Rolling Stone. What happens when they talk about 9/11 and the Wellstone murder are about details and where and when and how rather than a rolling of the eyes? What happens when we have actual names and court cases and confessions and Newsweek and Wall Street Journal and New York Times front page stories about the trial of some still living principals in the JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King Jr. murders? Our whole world will be rocked.
And somebody will need to make an app for that in a darn big hurry. But thanks to the folks at The Next Big Thing, it's already in the work, guys. Things will be different. Our whole perception of life and what we should be doing in life will be changed forever. It might be scary, but it's where we need to go. Down the rabbit hole, folks. Step right up. Don't be shy. Okay, now careful, one at a time. No pushing. Everybody will get their turn. Easy now, careful. There you go. We're the next big thing. We bring the world to your vehicle, your doorstep, right on up to your mind.
And now we bring you the New American Dream big commercial sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, the U.S. Army, Google, Nike, CNN, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspaper to millions of people, and nobody gets fired or killed. Jim Fetzer. The evidence that none of the official plane crashes actually took place is simply overwhelming, even if there are 9/11 truth groups that want to avoid it. Not only did Flight 77 not hit the Pentagon, but Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville, and even though we have all seen videos purporting to show Flight 11 hit the North Tower and Flight 175 hit the South, we know that those videos are faked and fabricated one way or another. As Pilots for 9/11 Truth has shown, Flight 93 was in the air on 9/11, but it was over Champaign, Urbana, after it had purportedly crashed in Shanksville. And Flight 175 was also in the air, but was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. long after it had purportedly effortlessly entered the South Tower. Indeed, FAA registration records show that the plane corresponding to those flights were not deregistered until September 28, 2005, which means that none of the official plane crashes actually took place. It has been astonishing to me to discover that the atrocities of 9/11 were not simply allowed to happen, but come closer to having been produced as a Hollywood-style spectacle with phantom flights, faked phone calls, and fabricated crash sites. Anyone who wants to continue in a state of naive belief in their government as a nurturing institution that is dedicated to the best interests of the American people and to promoting their welfare should read no further, because 9/11 appears to have been a national security event that was approved at the highest levels of the Bush-Cheney administration, including the CIA, the Pentagon, the NSA, and the White House itself. When consideration is given to the totality of the evidence, no alternative explanation is reasonable.
This has been the New American Dream Big Commercial, sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, Google, Nike, CNN, the National Football League, and lots of other people. We bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspaper to millions of people, and nobody gets fired or killed.
I'd like to now bring on our second guest, Michael Skinner. Michael Skinner is a nationally known award-winning advocate survivor addressing the issues of trauma, abuse, and mental health concerns through public speaking and his music. He has spoken at the National Press Club, was a keynote presenter for a conference held by the United Nations, the State Department, and Georgetown University on the sexual exploitation and trafficking of children and adults, and he has appeared on many TV, radio, and internet shows. He was part of the Oprah Winfrey shows that addressed the issues of males sexually abused as children. His music and advocacy website has been visited by well over a million visitors, and he has formed the nonprofit The Surviving Spirit that offers hope, healing, and help for those impacted by trauma, abuse, and mental health challenges through the creative arts, advocacy, education, a monthly newsletter, and website. Hello, Michael. Are you there?
I am here. Hi.
How are you doing?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Fine, fine. Mike, are you were in New Hampshire, is that right?
I am.
I got that right?
You are correct.
Could you tell me up? Could you tell us about your group, The Surviving Spirit?
Absolutely. It's a nonprofit that was formed about 4 years ago, and basically it was to utilize the creative arts, education, and advocacy to address the issues of trauma, abuse, and mental health challenges. Now, it's a broad spectrum there, but, you know, and we do focus a lot on child abuse in all of its forms, but, you know, trauma, if you've been in a car accident or, you know, horrific storm or something that has impacted you, that is still trauma. And what we do is we offer resources for that, and we send out a monthly newsletter, which is always sharing a lot of great resources and what people are doing, whether it's an organization or what I like to term as, you know, the mom and pops, because sometimes this stuff is so overwhelming you think you're all alone doing this. But there's actually a lot of people out in this country and throughout the world actually doing a lot of good things. So we like to shine a little light on them, because, you know, a lot of times it is the major organizations that get that, you know, the spotlight, so to speak. So we try to show those that, whether they've just released a book, some music, they've got some artwork, or they're speaking somewhere, or they've created an advocacy organization, maybe they've created their own nonprofit to help, you know, the homeless, whatever it is, we want to show as much as we can, and always building the resources from the website to share more alternative healing techniques as well, is besides, so it's not just following the medical model. And we don't throw out, you know, we're not an anti-bashing, you know, medicine, if you will, but we do like to show that there are other ways to healing, because sometimes you've spent too much time in the medical model, you're talked out, and you know, maybe you need to look at something different. So just trying to offer alternatives and different resources for folks and let them, and but again, using the creative arts, that's a gentle way to, you know, to draw people in, and people can spend time at the site, and you know, and that saying, take what you like and leave the rest. So that's pretty much what we're doing and trying to do, and we keep, you know, trying to build on that.
Well, where is it? Is there a physical building, or as well as a website, or is it just
no?
Is it the
right
website?
Now, it is just a website. It's the website. We do some events, and we've done some events in conjunction with others. But that is the ultimate goal, to have an actual physical space. We do also market and sell the creative resources, whatever that may be, whether it's a book or a CD, or someone's made something, you know, with the crafts with the hands. Again, made by folks who've been impacted by those issues, but that is the ultimate goal, and that is, you know, the dream is to eventually have a physical space that, you know, we can even do more of this.
Michael, why did you start it? How did you come to see the need for a group like this?
Because for many years, since 1993, I've been, as a musician, when my own issues of post-traumatic stress and depression hit many years ago, and then, you know, that medical model, and then being, I don't like the term mentally ill, but I will use it because that's what I was diagnosed with, that, you know, that I would never work again and all that good stuff. And by what I do, I've proven that false. And I just started speaking out as an advocate and aligning myself with other, you know, advocacy groups and individuals trying to change that paradigm. And finding that, you know, as music got me, you know, invited to a lot of places, because a lot of times I would just volunteer just to, you know, to sing at a place or offer my sound system to help, you know, with these folks. And whether it was a small group of 20 or 30 people or a large event of, you know, several hundred, I was always meeting folks that were just, you know, because I'm singing and performing now. I've released, you know, the first CD, and people are coming up to me and just showing me, whether it was their artwork or maybe they've done their own song or I get to hear them, or their creative crafts. And this light, you know, this light bulb went off. I said, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could have a place to showcase these things, to show that there is life after whatever you've gone through. And, you know, so it's another, a gentle way, again, of breaking down the stigma and discrimination that people can't do things. So that was really what planted the seeds. It was just my being out all the time and seeing this, whether I was in a, you know, a small peer support center, and like I say, doing a music group, and there's only 20 people in the room, or I'm in a large conference, you know, and I'm in the exhibit hall, and you know, there's several hundred people walking through, but they always would be sharing their stuff with me, or I'd get to see it, and that really was what set the seeds for that, to say, well, if we can get more people out there and help, you know, showcase what they're doing, and also help as a gentle way of breaking down some of the stigma and discrimination. So that's.
You said that the idea started came from your own personal issues. Do you want to share up any details about that or not?
I'm quite comfortable. I've become an open book on this, because it was what I like to say is my secrets. You know, caused me to become ill many years ago at the ripe old age of 39, because I kept these things secret, which were, you know, the child abuse that I experienced as a young boy and a teenager at the hands of my parents. And it was all forms of child abuse. And again, it was from both of them and some of their perverted friends. It was sexual, it was physical, it was emotional, there was neglect. There was a lot of issues, but I buried all of that through music, because I became a professional musician as a drummer, but I also was a workaholic, and then I was in the music business, and I just stayed busy all the time, running from those secrets. So eventually that caught up with me, and that's when I had, you know, back then I called it was a breakdown, but now I see it as a breakthrough. And I had to really look hard at what had caused me to come to that point, because the flashbacks wouldn't stop. It was basically the trauma was just so much, and I learned everything that I could, how trauma and abuse and depression, what it did to me, not only in just in my head, but, you know, spiritually and physically, you know, all of those things, emotionally, it had a huge impact on my life. And I said, I don't want to be here anymore. So slowly but surely, and I'm still continuing to this day learning you know, I'm still healing. But I'm in a better space. I can talk about it. I can play music again. I can do things. I can be on a radio show with you folks. So I know that there is healing. And so when I go out to speak or even writing a song, my whole platform, if you will, is to offer hope, healing, and help, whether I'm speaking, whether it's on this show, writing a song, whatever I'm doing, I'm not going to change the world, but boy, if I can help be a part of changing, you know, my little neighborhood of people I come in contact with, that's really what I'm trying to do, and it's always evolving because I'm always learning new things all the time, and I like networking and collaborating with others that are like-minded spirits. Even though we may not always see eye to eye on things, the whole thing is to really address how trauma and abuse and mental health challenges really impact all of us, and not just those of us who've experienced, but, you know, it affects our relationships with others, whether it's family, friends, work, it affects society. So that's, you know, that really what helps push me to keep doing what I'm doing.
Michael, in reading your intro, I saw that you had quite a bit of public exposure, success, if you might call it. Do you feel that way too? I mean, you've really taken this project and it made it into something. You must feel good about that.
You know, thank you. That wasn't the original goal, if you will. It sort of has happened that I just keep chipping away at it because, you know, I just want, when I started, you know, getting my health back and my mental clarity, I just wanted to go back to being a musician. And, you know, now I'm divorced, you know, my ex had left me after all of this, and I just thought, well, I can just go on the road again and be a, you know, singer-songwriter. And that, but for some reason, I just kept being pulled back to this, or someone would say, hey, can you speak here, or write an article, and so in my heart, I'm not complaining. I do like what I'm doing, but it is just, but again, I think because of my business background and being a musician, you know, just trying to get the word out there, I've just been persistent in it. And so I am persistent. If there's one thing that is true with me, I keep knocking on doors. And if a door is closed to me, I'll crawl in, you know, the cellar window to get there. So I just keep chipping away. But again, the idea is how to create more awareness, because I'm just, you know, I'm tired. So now it has become a mission, if you will, but it's become a calling. I don't want to come off sounding pompous with this, but it's what I feel. And I feel good because I'm helping others, but, you know, it's also helping me, you know, in the long run. It's so, and now I'm grateful for what I do, that I can write songs and it touches people. I mean, that's the greatest thing, you know, to do a song that, and perform it, and it reaches someone else, whether they've heard it off the CD or off the internet or hearing me live, that helps them. I mean, I loved what I did as, you know, in rock and roll bands. That was great, but there's something about this that's priceless. There's more of a reward, if you will, at the end of the day. So I just, I'm going to keep doing this till, you know, my dying days, if you will. I still plan to be around for a while, but it is a passion of mine, but trying to do it in the right vein and for all the right reasons, and, you know, to keep checking myself with, you know, others to make sure I'm doing the right thing.
Well, Mike, thanks for taking time to visit with us. And in closing, could you tell folks again about the group and also about where they can go to find you?
Absolutely. It's the Surviving Spirit. And all they need to do is just Google that, Surviving Spirit, and our website will come up. But the website address is survivingspirit.com. And we have a really good newsletter. They can sign up for it at the website. We're in the process of upgrading and updates to the website, but they can still reach us and sign up for the newsletter or see the newsletter right at the website itself. And there's a lot of resources. If they have resources they want to share with us, please send them. So, again, and thank you.
Thank you, Michael, very much for taking the time to visit with us. Have a good night.
You too. Take care.
Yep. See you later.
Bye.
For decades, centuries, America and the world have been protected by those strong enough, smart enough, to hear the voice of honor calling to their hearts. Those brave warriors to whom we owe our freedom. Who can forget Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, George McGovern, Peter Morin, Ammon Hennessy, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood. And today we salute those who continue to answer the call.
The few, the proud, the women from Code Pink, Food Not Bombs, a global force for good. Be all you can be. Join We Are Chains or your local 9/11 Truth Group today. Aim high with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. An army of one or two or three at 4 a.m, underwater through the swamp with a hammer in their teeth, over the fence, through the fence, into the building to hammer on United States military killing machines and destroy them, the Plowshares Movement, defending freedom and humanity since September 9, 1980. We're looking for a few good women in black. Be part of the action. The world can't wait. Veterans for Peace, it's not just a job, it's an adventure. Peace is our profession. Join the Occupy movement. They're strong, and there's Catholic workers strong. Semper Fi, hoorah.
He's a cool dude. He smokes and drinks on the sly, plays basketball with the other dudes, all in three-piece suits. And still, they're so cool. Nobody knows where he's from, but they were so glad when he got here. Now they're wondering if he'll ever leave. He's one of those guys. First job out of college was with the CIA. Do you ever leave the CIA? Just ask it. He's complicit in 9/11 attacks and bombing and killing and locking away people in prison forever. Though when he talks to big groups, he talks like he's one of us. The best, brightest, hippest, and coolest dude in the room. When he drinks, he doesn't always drink beer, but when he comes into my place and orders a beer, tall, dark, cool beer, he also drinks Thucydides, my spit and my urine. He's the most powerful, hippest, coolest dude in the world. Stay thirsty, my friend.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Next year, 2013, will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. There will be books and movies and specials all about that day, all trying to tell us how we feel and think about that day, when everyone already knows in their gut and in their heart how they think and feel about that day. In our town, there are many people who think that Kennedy was killed by Oswald and that's all there is to it. There are also people who are not insane or retarded or idiots who know this is not the way it was because they can just feel it in their toes. One of those is Johnny Moon. Johnny Moon has a story of his own, and part of his very own story is the story of that day, November 22, 1963, the most important day there ever was and will be until September 11, 2001 came, and that is the most important day ever and ever and will be until the day they attack Iran. And the funny thing, those days are all connected. They are kind of all the same day. I know, right? The idiots don't know that. They never will, but Johnny Moon knows. Would you like to hear more?
Someone woke up very early in the morning and went right to the guns to see if they were still there and all right, safe and clean and happy. Someone called someone and talked over a final note that had kept them from sleeping past 3 that morning. Someone else wakened with a smile to think of the cumulative power of all the months of preparations finally coming to fruition. Two persons worried that all the details were in place. What could possibly go wrong? One person woke up at the alarm clock, wondering for a moment where he was, rolled to the bed table to check departure times once again. Someone else ask someone at the end of breakfast, but what about the children? I'm not sure I know what you're talking about. That was the only response. Before they crumpled white napkins, tossed them along with a couple dollar bills on the plates, and went off to meet the plane.
Catholic school construction heated up around the United States during the whole first half of the 20th century. People were glad they had survived the Second World War, and everyone was excited to expand, to move into a new place, buy a toaster, and get on with the exciting new prospect of living. And in the 1960s, every burg and ton and ville in the Midwest boasted a Catholic block of school, rectory, and convent. The sisters and priests and bishops and parents energized each other to offer a firm alternative to the suggested boogeyman, anti-religion communism. They constructed a cozy campfire of Catholicism in the middle of town and invited all to join to come sit around the fire and warm their hands and their feet around the pulsating heart of Jesus. Then a Catholic president was elected, and Pope John XXIII called the Second Vatican Council. The United States had recently introduced the universe to nuclear weapons and tied, and the new Catholic president talked about going to the moon. Civil rights in Vietnam turned the cozy campfire into a forest fire. In the heat of it all, the stout soul in the basement, the school boiler pumping proudly like Boxer on a frozen Midwest morning. If the mostly unseen boiler did not work, Sister would send a classroom representative flying downstairs, leaping whole sets of steps to tell Mr. Somebody that there was no heat in Sister's room. With no heat, everything rumbled and dragged to a halt. The learning did not go on without the pulsing of the heart of the boiler in the school basement, next to the school stage in the kitchen where the Catholic daughters made the triangle funeral sandwiches. The school janitor charged downstairs at 5 a.m. by the light of the full moon to stoke the fire, proud of the task he had been given by the priests and sisters after he moved to town from the farm. The moon, the man, and the boiler, the basics, the fundamentals of Catholic education, worked together to send the heat to what would soon be the sacred symphony upstairs, directed by the celestial exotic nuns who all came from somewhere else to be with these town kids in their snowsuits and 14-buckle overshoes, a tune repeated in hundreds of cities and towns each morning, thousands of lighted flames culminating, generating upward in one big homecoming bonfire of 1960s glory in the United States of America. And that was how life began, out of that primordial ooze of snow slush, flavored with radiation, colored by rambler exhaust and cocker spaniel piss, remembering the past, yet rushing with arms wide toward the future. Caught between the Flintstones and the Jetsons, Captain Marvel, My Favorite Martian, The Twilight Zone, Bewitched, Aliens, Roswell, a world wanting to know how far it could go. On the edge of science fiction, of fantastic ideas about time and space, and society, race, poverty, war, and religion. These innocents in the upstairs classrooms assumed the best from America. They looked at JFK on TV, smart, handsome, smiling, funny, and just knew they were in the best place and time there ever had been, or maybe they just assumed it was always this way and always would be. Maybe that was it. Maybe they did not think so much as feel. And when they grew up, not too long from now, they were going to the moon and outer space and to dances and football games, and they were in love. It was just the best place ever, and it was going to get better. They couldn't wait to grow up. They so much wanted to be alive, to live. All this, and the Beatles, too. And every morning, there were the old people at Mass. The persons these young people were resigned to someday becoming, half kneeling in the back in the shadows, watching the children, someone they used to be watching, banging their elbows and rosary beads on the wooden pew back, still confident of their own specialness, of being Catholic, of going out in a blaze of glory. And that's the way Johnny Moon felt on the morning of Friday, November 22nd, 1963, confident. Everything was possible, everything, even losing weight. And so he chose to do this, walk to school and lose weight, not because it was easy, but because it was hard.
Now, well, just let me say that Johnny was a fat boy, a fat young boy in the third grade, who thought he could fly, because he saw things that others did not. Not because he was so special, just that he cared enough to look. It's true, the world is not as we see it. We see it, but it's different, way different, like that, if you want to know the truth. And the truth is that Johnny could, in fact, fly, but he looked like he could not, so you might assume he did not, but he did. He looked less like Superman and more like a fat robin, big boned, wearing buckle over shoes and a snowsuit. But his snowsuit was blue, not red like a robin, so maybe he was a puppet, a flying blue Sesame Street puppet with special powers, and corduroy cap with a button on top and a buckle strap under the chin. A fat young third grade boy headed down the steps of his home, wearing a snowsuit and buckle over shoes in late November, trying to run as best he could, carrying his sack lunch in one hand and trying with the other to buckle his hat strap under his chin as his mother had just shouted from the doorway, who took off down the sidewalk, shuffling under all that weight, which actually wasn't all that much, but he thought it was. That's all that really mattered. He was inspired. He wanted to do something about it and do other great things, too. Well, he took off from his front porch with his arms up and out, one hand holding that lunch sack like Superman, headed to work. Not that Johnny actually thought he could fly, but he thought some people maybe could, and you never really know till you put your arms out. Tried it before, so he kind of already knew that much about himself, but he was inspired. He wanted to try again. So he took off again, his eyes wide, his arms out and up, though already they were getting a little tired. Blood was draining down his arms to make his face red. He'd try to fly, settle for a little running until he got really tired, and he would walk. He'd walk as far as he could, but would it be far enough? Well, he didn't know. He'd never done this before. He was finally going to try. He was going to try. And he smiled. Ah, damn it. He smiled as he chugged down the broken sidewalk across the street, out of sight of his white-painted home, as his mother checked the sky, folded her arms across her chest, and ducked her head against the sudden chill to head back inside. He pitched his chin, gritted his teeth, and looked straight ahead down that sidewalk. It stretched straight to forever, almost. He might not exactly fly. He would do the other things. He'd lose weight, get in shape, maybe go to the moon. He did not have to be able to fly to lose weight or go to the moon. And he would start by walking to school this morning. No problem. He was an American and he was special. He just was. What could he say? But still, between Johnny Moon and the school and the church were a few blocks of Russians and communists and UFO space aliens and chances that he'd go to hell and fat. Blocks and blocks of being out in the wide open and being fat. There were kids and people with money and people who were not nice. He'd been told they were there. He told all manners of lies and engaged in deceit and, lies and deception. But Johnny Moon did not let that bother him because he was special. He was an American and a Catholic, too.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO school lunch ladies are about average.
And that's it for another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week. That's Thanksgiving Day. Same time, same place. We'd like to thank worldnewstrust.com and thespiritualun.org and June2508.com, our sponsors. We'd especially like to thank you, and I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.